This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Like it or not, political ideology frames the way we understand public life and can even shape our close relationships. Now, we might be tempted to think that people have always divided themselves along ideological grounds, but you know, our attachment to isms of political discourse is a relatively modern phenomenon. Here to tell us how they came about is Lloyd Kramer. He's a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and he's giving a seminar at the Friday Center in Chapel Hill on the influence of Western isms. Lloyd Kramer, welcome to the State of Things. Good
Thank
to have you,
Frank. It's nice to be here.
So this, you know, we talk about this, and I think it's come up more and more now, how we're attached to these isms and how they're dividing us. When did isms sort of creep into public discourse?
Well, the systematic articulation of isms really began to develop in the early 19th century after the era of the American and French revolutions. Human beings have always identified in groups of religion or family or clan or state. But isms were systematic forms of thought in which groups of people promoted a set of specific ideas like nationalism or conservatism or liberalism or socialism. And all of these isms date to the first half of the 19th century, and they emerged in Europe and in North America.
And were those among the first, nationalism? What were some of the first?
They were among the first to have a kind of systematic advocates. Edmund Burke laid out theories which became known as conservatism. He himself did not say, I'm an advocate of conservatism, but the idea that we must protect traditions and build on past institutions. Or nationalism very much grew out of the American and French revolutions. The idea that the people, rather than a king, embody the state.
Well, that's an important point right there. You can see the kind of co-evolution of this, can't you? And you talk about this, the idea that it's only at a time when individuals believe they have some role in public discourse or that their discourse has an influence on public policy that you'd begin talking about these ideas, right?
That's right. So isms are really connected to modern ideas of citizenship and democratic public life, because if, in fact, the king decides what we're going to do, there's not really a systematic campaign to reshape public opinion or so forth. But this is why our lives now are so dominated by the isms, because we live in a world of modern media, modern political parties, contending economic factions, all of whom have advocates for a set of ideas.
And we humans are uniquely and biologically suited to understand and think in terms of symbolic reasoning. We can have a banner about around an ism, an ideology called nationalism or communism, and think that we subscribe to it, right?
That's right.
That it identifies us.
Somehow people have a need to be connected to other human beings. This is one of our characteristics. So the question is, what will be the motivating forces, ideas, symbols that give us that sense of identity? And for some of us, for all of us, it can be everything from the Carolina or Duke basketball team to the American nation to China to an ideology, an ism that is more specific on a particular issue.
We talked about the political revolutions that kind of cleared the ground for this sort of thinking, ideas of democracy and public participation. Also technological revolutions, most notably the printing press.
Exactly. You could say that the isms are also a product of modern print technology, and this may well be why they have gained even more power over the last several decades, because it's now so easy to organize social networks, social media, computer networks that are all organized around a set of common ideas. And therefore, the idea of a shared public space, which was the original concept of democracy, is always challenged by the fragmentation into ideological and political communities.
But these things grew up together. I mean, if you're a pamphleteer, you have, I mean, print capitalism really plays an important part in this, because if your job is printing, you'd like to get people picking up your pamphlets. So to stir up a controversy over an ideological question that may not have even been in currency is a pretty lucrative business.
So you could say people had a financial stake in keeping the argument going,
right?
Because that's how you sell newspapers and pamphlets.
And generating an argument and also kind of labeling it so that it's easy enough to follow and we know who's on which side and what these things mean. Was it, as I began to think about your ideas and what you're talking about here, I wondered if it was, if there was any sense that it was jarring for people who, again, had been, you know, sort of growing turnips and waiting for the next tax fiat, and would it generate a pitchfork rebellion over that, but certainly not an ideological rebellion. And then somewhere in the 17th century, as you say, we begin to think about ourselves as political actors, as participants. Was this jarring in any way?
I think it's always jarring to people when there is social and political and cultural conflict. There is a desire in almost every society, especially among those who lead it, to have unity, coherence, everybody on the same page. If you have a society in which it is by definition divided into contending parties, then there is conflict built into the ideological struggle. And of course, there was always conflict. But what makes the modern ideologies so powerful is that the conflict takes a more coherent form and it mobilizes large numbers of people around a set of symbols and ideas.
It's also interesting that at this moment, nationalism arises too. I mean, I think it's hard for people to understand that, you know, in the 14th and 13th century, people who live in what is now France outside of Paris really didn't think of themselves as French. There was no such thing. In fact, your king or queen probably didn't even speak French. You know, the idea of these bonds that linked the aristocratic families wasn't about nationalism. It was about power. So nationalism arises in about the same time that we see ideas of democracy and more public participation. And it's paradoxically, it's when people become more fragmented. So they unite under these national borders and then begin to divide along these ideological lines.
That's right. I think the meaning of identity evolves. And this is the other reason I think the isms have such power. They not only identify social groups, individual human beings come to identify themselves with these larger isms like nationalism or later socialism or communism or fascism or whatever. And the reason they do that is they look for the emotional security that comes from being part of a group of fellow thinking people. And I do think these identities took on a new form in the modern world, because before the modern age, you were sort of defined by if you were born a noble or you were born a peasant, you were born into the lower class, you were never going to change your identity. The isms all carry the modern assumption that you can transform yourself and other people and a society as a whole. So not only do the isms mark a change in the evolution of political history, they mark an evolution in the conception of selfhood as something that can be recreated, reconstructed, and changed. It's a very radical transition.
And as you say, on the optimistic side, it holds out the promise of agency. I am more than just a turnip farmer. I can transform myself because of the imagination, through my imagination and the use of these words. The downside is there's a suggestion that you might have had to lose something, a certain security in the emotional security in just being a turnip farmer. Do I have to take away a security, that security that you'd always enjoyed first in order to replace it with this, or do they have kind of something?
Well, in fact, most isms and ideologies have overlapping layers. Very few people would have only one identity. So you might say, I am an American farmer who went to this school and live in this town. In other words, identities are multi-layered. Isms are a more symbolic, abstract layer of identity that meshes with all those other layers. But when you have a multiplicity of identities, I think you open the door to more threats to the identity, because then the question is my identity fluid? Is it at risk? Is it being threatened in ways that maybe it wasn't if you were just a turnip farmer and your father and mother had been turnip farmers and nothing much had changed in your village for 50 years?
Well, and I wonder if there are sort of hierarchies, too, of content, emotional content. If you're base identity is turnip farmer, and there's something about a particular ism that suggests to you that turnip farming will be changed forever should it take hold. You know, are there these hierarchies?
And in fact, in order to protect my turnip farming life, I need to embrace this particular ism, let's say nationalism or protectionism, or there are any number of isms that emerge to say why we need to take these actions to protect you as a human being. And that's why in our own society, it's not just a political conflict. It is a psychological battle over selfhood and group identities. And I think it's intensified in American society within the last 20 years. It's always there, but it goes in waves of deeper or less intensity.
Has it become more abstract? I'm thinking about our comparison here with turnips. That's the thing you grow and eat. And then there's whiteness, which is a socially constructed idea, or blackness,
yeah.
In terms of a socially constructed ideas that if you adhere to them, you can feel, if you're an uneducated white man, a certain threat to your privilege that you hadn't earned but didn't realize you didn't really have coming to you.
This is one of the questions is, how do ideologies provide both a view or an aspiration of the future? All isms provide that. They also provide some security that offers protection against a fear. And we could say politics is always a battle between aspiration and fear, and each ism exemplifies that. And therefore, people identify their own aspirations and their own fears by the ism that they support.
How common is it for people then? It sounds fundamental, and in some ways it becomes essential to us, even though it's adopted. How common is it for people to change ideology, or how foundational is it for people?
That's an interesting question, because ideologies are a lot like religions, religions are not exactly systematic ideologies, but people tend to change their ideologies most commonly in late adolescence, early adulthood, and I think it continues to happen at all ages, but people become fixed in those ideologies as their identities become fixed, or as they become more stable. And therefore, this is one reason I think political parties aim so much attention at younger people, just like other advertisers. If you can get them young, you're more likely to hold on to them with your ism.
I wonder, too, you put your finger on another important question that experts have seen happening now over the past decades, where we've stopped becoming actors in a political marketplace and transferred ourselves to consumers. And so our choice is really represented in a commercial marketplace, and political choice seems to have taken a second place. Not to say that there isn't great commercial value in the discourse over politics. Has that transformation taken place, do you think, and what effect does it have on the ideological content?
That I do think there has been a marketing of isms, so that if one imagines the early advocates, Edmund Burke versus John Stuart Mill versus Karl Marx, you have this sort of image of systematic political theories being articulated by major thinkers. Now the idea is to grab a soundbite. This is conservatism. Boom. Three words that you can, maybe you can tweet your ideology. Contemporary political movements are more into tweeting and Facebooking than systematic analysis. That's what they borrow from branding, consumerism, and advertising.
What about those movements that we might consider as ideologies, but that those who embrace the ideology and practice it wouldn't agree to a term or even see it? White supremacy, for instance. There might be people, although I don't know now in the near future whether people even feel the shame to run away from it anymore. But there was a time when no one would admit to being a racist or white supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's an ideology that certainly has a hold on the American imagination.
Well, there were certainly systematic advocates of racism, which makes it like other isms in the 19th and early 20th century. Of course, Nazism itself is the most powerful example, but people like French thinker Gobineau in the 19th century actually wrote books arguing, the white race is superior to other races. And there are racists, obviously, in the world today who accept those ideas. And therefore, I would say racism is another systematic ideology or ism, although people are more hesitant to affirm that one today in words, but not necessarily in practices or policies.
How is it that the counter to racism, when it was an acceptable ideology, never had an ism, that the civil rights movement, that activities that would embrace civil rights really – I can't think of the ism that describes it.
Well, of course, in the anti-slavery period, there was abolitionism, right, which was a very powerful ism. The civil rights movement probably had an ideology that we could call certain kinds of liberalism or humanism that essentially affirmed that human beings are equal. And yet the movement itself probably didn't have the same ism attached to it, except, I would say, humanism, broadly defined.
What about the idea that isms change over time? I'm thinking of feminism in particular. Mm-hmm. Here's a concept that has certainly evolved enormously over time. Is that common?
Yes, I'd say most isms evolve. I mean, liberalism, classical liberalism in the 19th century was a very much laissez-faire kind of philosophy, market philosophy. It evolved. The core idea remained the same. Individuals must be supported and free, but the content changed so that in order to be that, you need public education. You need public health care. So liberals still advocated for individual well-being, but they decided government had a role in facilitating that. The same with feminism. Of course, in the 19th century, the big struggle was to get the right to vote. Feminism today still needs to defend that, perhaps, but it became much more of a social and economic movement. And so, yes, all isms evolve, but in order to retain a certain link to the past, they usually have some core elements that remain the same.
I think I have this right, but that there is something emerging today called that we could call Trumpism. Is there such a thing, do you think?
Trumpism is a new ism that people are discussing. Yeah. And it is, of course, like all isms, a movement that draws on multiple earlier isms. It clearly is some kind of an amalgam of nationalism, of certain kinds of conservatism. I mean, certainly people see it linked to certain traditions of authoritarianism, where the idea is you have a very strong leader who will stand out above all the rest. It is an ism that's linked sometimes to populism, that the masses are resisting the elites. Trumpism is clearly something that I think we have to understand because it's a little different from all of the other isms, and yet it gains power by tapping into nationalism, conservatism, populism, and perhaps even certain kinds of white racism that give it emotional power.
Are there examples of that sort of thing in which the kind of the amalgamation and to some extent the annihilation, I mean, if you think about the way in which his ideology crosses boundaries at certain points, that it sort of annihilates and takes over an earlier ism or ideology and amalgamates the two?
Well, certainly almost every ism gets integrated into other ideological and political movements. There are very few that remain absolutely pure because they grow, they attract new followers, and they spread. And human thought is always evolving. It never stays the same. That's why history is so important. That's where we started. History is the way to understand the confusion and complexity of what we're dealing with right now. It didn't just fall from the sky.
Well, and along those lines, the complaint these days is that our ideological silos are making it difficult for us to actually have the kind of dialogue that would help us move forward more productively.
I want to say that at the university, I think, is also evolving and recognizing the need to be more involved with a dialogue. I happen to run a program called the Program in the Humanities, which is devoted to connecting faculty and the state, and it is all about dialogues. And I think the way that we're living in these silos calls for a new kind of dialogue.
Yeah, but what does that mean even? And is it even possible given how entrenched and deep we are?
I think that the social media are driving us into silos in a way that even the most rabid ideologist of the 19th century could only have dreamed of, because you can instantly reach, you know, millions of people with emails and tweets and... So I think the great challenge is how can we use the media, which actually constructed communities in the old days. You talked about print capitalism and newspapers. Now, in many ways, the media are producing a fragmentation. So how do we recover a dialogue that emerged with the modern mass media in a way that sustains a democratic political culture? Because I do think that when isms take over completely, usually democratic societies go into crisis. We certainly saw that in Europe in the 20th century, and I think we're facing a similar threat in the United States today.
Lloyd Kramer is a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill, giving a two-part seminar at the Friday Center for Continuing Education on the Influence of Isms. Lloyd Kramer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank. I'm glad to be here.
Coming up, music from the Gravy Boys. Stay with us.